Electricity, a big idea that's inspired countless new ones. From powering the light bulb to virtually powering our entire lives. 30 years ago, State Street launched the Spider S&P 500 ETF, SPY. A big idea that inspired the world to invest differently. And still does. What can you do with SPY?
Before investing, consider the fund's investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses. Visit SSGA.com for a prospectus containing this and other information. Read it carefully before investing. SPY is subject to risks similar to those of stocks. All ETFs are subject to risk, including possible loss of principal. Alps Distributors, Inc. Distributor.
Right now on Last Call, can't stop, won't stop. The market makes another record, and three very big names could be signaling even more gains to come. A manic run, a strange market dynamic that could push shares of NVIDIA above 1,000 in just 2 weeks. The wheel coming off, literally breaking developments around a new mishap on a Boeing jet. Nothing to see here. The economic milestone, you likely won't hear a thing about it tonight. State of the Union. Plus, Rivian's jumpstart. Investors cheering as new EVs are unveiled, but there's something buried in an SEC filing that we're going to show you. And swinging big, Netflix unveiling what maybe its boldest, most bonkers live event yet. All that and more over the hour. So as always, belly up or buckle up, because Last Call is up right now. All right. Hi, everybody. Good evening here. Good afternoon out west. We're going to have all that and more across the hour. But first up on Last Call, as the breaking news graphic suggested, countdown to the State of the Union address. President Biden set to deliver that address before Congress and the country in just under 2 hours from now. According to all kinds of reports, he is set to focus on a number of issues related to what we talk about, business and the economy. Eamon Javers joining us now with a preview of what we might expect CNBC style tonight. Eamon.
That's right, Brian. We are expecting the president to focus large portions of the speech tonight on the economy, including a number of proposals that are likely to be unpopular in corporate boardrooms. And we're already starting to see some of that pre-reaction rolling in. Now, White House officials say President Biden will call for a hike in the corporate minimum tax from 15% to 21%. We expect he will call for denying corporate tax breaks for salaries over $1 million. Under current law, companies can't deduct CEO and top executive salaries, so this would represent an expansion of those limits. In the tax arena, Biden is expected to call for a quadrupling of the stock buyback tax from 1% to 4%, which the White House says will encourage corporations to invest in productivity rather than windfalls for investors, as they put it. He is also likely to propose closing the corporate jet loophole and a 25% minimum tax on billionaires. And on the budget, Biden is expected to call for cutting the deficit by $3 trillion over a decade and to criticize Republican plans that he says would raise the deficit over the next 10 years. Brian, this is a president running for re-election at an economy with terrific economic indicators in terms of employment, wages, and the stock market. But it's also in a climate of a sour economic mood, largely driven by inflation. The president's challenge tonight is to persuade Americans that 4 more years of Bidenomics is better than the alternative. Back over to you.
Well, they're populist ideas, Eamon. I get it. Listen, 25% minimum tax on billionaires sounds great until you realize that pretty much no billionaire has any income, so there's nothing to tax. They're billionaires generally in equity. Are these things that the business community is really going to latch onto, or is this more just electioneering?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen some of the business groups tonight putting out statements, Brian, just within the past hour or so, saying, you know, beware of demonizing American business, beware of taxing job creators too much. I think you're going to hear more of that rhetoric in the morning once they see what the president has to lay out. But, you know, bear in mind, look, this is a wish list. Every State of the Union is a laundry list and a wish list. All of this stuff has to get through Congress in order to get to Joe Biden's desk. And with a Republican majority, at least for now, on Capitol Hill in the House, that's not likely to happen. So these are ideas that are designed to galvanize conversation, galvanize his political campaign, but not necessarily galvanize actual legislation that actually gets passed this year, certainly.
Eamon Javers, appreciate it always, my friend. Thank you very much. All right, and ahead of the State of the Union, while we try to stay away from straight politics here on Last Call and CNBC, it is our job to help try to make sense of some of the big money numbers around politics and taxes. You just heard Eamon talk about it. Could be a big theme tonight. According to administration officials, the president will call for raising the corporate tax rate back to 28% from the current 21%, also raising his own minimum corporate tax rate to 21% from 15%. Now, whatever you may think of that, maybe you love it, maybe you hate it, maybe you don't care. Corporations, they'll tolerate it. They'll likely raise costs a little to cover it, and they're going to move on. But will it matter for the country? Well, you can decide for yourself, but I'm going to give you some raw numbers, okay? Corporate taxes aren't that big of a deal. They account for about 7 to 10% of total federal government tax collections. Now, last fiscal year, the government collected $4.4 trillion in taxes. About $425 billion of that was corporate tax. So if we raise the corporate tax rate by 7%, that would theoretically raise about $30 billion in new tax revenue every year. And while $30 billion is nothing to sneeze at, it may sound like a lot when it comes to D.C., it's not a lot. The federal government is now spending $6.1 trillion per year, or about $16.7 billion every day. We are spending about $2.5 billion per day just on interest on our national debt. A lot of numbers. What does it all mean? Well, it means that all the money raised from raising corporate taxes would be enough to cover about 20 hours of government spending or pay for about 13 days of interest on the national debt. And here's something else to remember. When you hear all the electioneering tonight, the federal government is now spending nearly 30% more than it is taking in. This despite the fact that federal tax collections are at or near all-time highs in America. You got near record tax bills and record deficit. So if you take one thing away from this, it is this, and this is the truth. It's the numbers, not me. It is the spending, not the taxing, that probably matters more. Let's talk about more of this. We got Melissa DeRosa on set. We got Mick Mulvaney as well. Melissa, I'll start with you. Corporate taxes are an easy boogeyman, are they not, right? Millionaires and billionaires and corporate taxes, they sound really good. And maybe we need them. I don't know. $20 billion is still, $30 billion is still a lot of money. But my point is, I don't know if it's going to move the needle or move the voter.
Well, and okay, so look, as you said, they're an easy boogeyman, right? We're talking about billionaires, multimillionaires, and this is a play both to the base for Joe Biden, who's doing something to appease progressives, the Bernie bros, but also it's a populist message, right? Biden beat Trump in 2020 by winning back places like Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, working class white voters. And so this is essentially virtue signaling. This is not going to happen. It's a nice goal. And it's really about setting up a contrast between Joe Biden and Donald Trump. This is Joe Biden saying, I am for the working class American. Mm-hmm. I want to make sure Medicare is solvent. I want to make sure Social Security is intact, middle class tax cuts, EITC, child care tax credit. And the other guy wants to pay for corporate millionaires and billionaires to get additional tax revenue. And so that's really what this is about. It's not a practical implication. Joe Biden ran in 2020 saying he was going to roll back Trump's corporate tax cuts. And then he had both houses of Congress and didn't actually do it.
Yeah, you know, Mick, on Twitter, on social media, in proxy interviews, the president's team is working hard, and I'm sure we will hear this tonight, to convince Americans that the economy is good. And by a lot of measures, the economy is good. But if you're a voter that has to be convinced the economy is good, it's too late.
It is. I mean, you're still going to expect the president to talk about his successes, talk about where the economy is. He'd be foolish not to. But keep in mind, Brian, there's something really critical here tonight, which is this is one of the rare times that ordinary human beings actually follow politics. You might have as many as 50 million people watch this across various media tonight. And it's Joe Biden's chance to talk to folks outside the Beltway. It's not junkies like you and me or Melissa who follow this. Ordinary people follow this. So I think more so than whatever the details are of the message on a tax increase or whatever is going to be the image that he portrays. They're never going to remember what he said tonight. They will remember how he made them feel. Will he exude confidence, ability, health? quick wit and so forth. I think that matters a lot more tonight than whether or not he proposes to raise the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%. Yeah. Most Americans don't care about that. They care about who they are electing, not necessarily those policies.
To Mick's point, Melissa, and you're a political strategist, here's a difficult, but this is a question we have to acknowledge. We're all grown-ups watching this show, and I put it out on Twitter, X, as a poll. Is it more important what the president says or how the president says it? And I think you know what I'm getting at.
It's absolutely more important how the president says it. I mean, everyone tonight...
You could watch it with the sound off.
Exactly. You could watch it on mute and take away something more important than the actual substance that's coming out of his mouth. And, you know, a win for the president tonight will be that no one's talking about this speech in a week, right? The problem...
Why do you say that?
Because the problem will come if there's a gaffe, if he accidentally says the name of one world leader instead of another, if he stumbles on stage.
Well, he's reading,
but this is a long speech. We can expect that he's going to be heckled, right? You've got Marjorie Taylor Greene in the audience, of course. But, you know, this is the degradation of politics and government of today. And so I think Biden getting through the speech, looking energetic to the extent that he can look young, to the extent that there's color in his face.
Yeah.
I think that's more important than the words that are coming out of his mouth.
Would you agree with that, Mick? And by the way, let's hope there's no heckling. It's beneath the office, beneath any. We don't want to turn into England.
No, we don't. Well, we don't for a variety of reasons. But the decorum has been on a steady decline for all of our adult lifetimes. I remember when Barack Obama called out the Supreme Court about the Citizen United case with them sitting in front of him at a State of the Union. And as a result, I doubt you'll see the entire Supreme Court there again tonight. They haven't been to a full state of the, or the full court hasn't been to a State of the Union since. So, yeah, the decorum is going to continue to get bad because those will be, to Melissa's points, one of the stories that survives. If somebody gets a zinger in and a heckle, they're liable to raise $2 million off online in the next 24 hours, which is really depressing. We can talk later about the misalignment of incentives. But generally speaking, it's going to be the image that he portrays tonight that most people care about.
Is there one policy message, economic policy message, any policy message, Melissa, that the president should hammer home the most tonight?
You know, I think that the biggest problem the president faces going into this election cycle is that for the last 3 years, he and his administration have been ineffective at taking credit for the good work that they have done in their legislative accomplishments and translating that into spiking the football on, by a lot of measures, the greatest economy.
Why is that? Why is this what you do for a living? What's the problem?
Part of the problem is that Joe Biden isn't out. Right? Joe Biden has done fewer interviews than any president in American history. He's not out doing a lot of press conferences. And so much of this is repetition in messaging. You can't hear something once. You need to hear it 10, 15, 20 times. He should be at every groundbreaking and taking credit for it through the Infrastructure Act. Every time there's new jobs numbers out, inflation proves to be cooling. You know, we avoided the recession everybody was predicting and got that soft landing. He's not out there connecting that to his legislative accomplishments. And so if there's anything he can do tonight, this is the beginning of the general election. Trump is officially the nominee. Nikki Haley is out. Mm-hmm. Start to take credit for the work that you've done and where the economy stands today.
Mick, quick question, totally unrelated to the speech tonight. Do you think that Robert F. Kennedy Jr. or a third party has any shot, or at least shot at preventing somebody from getting 270 electoral votes?
If Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Shot at 270, no, because I don't think any of them will have enough votes to win a state, which is what you need to get electoral votes. Someone's going to get 270. No labels can't win a state. I don't think Robert F. Kennedy, even running as a Libertarian, can't win a state. But either of those sort of groups could tip the balance one way or the other. If Kennedy runs as a Libertarian, that really could hurt Biden. If Nikki Haley runs as no labels, which I do not see happening, but if it does, that would hurt Trump. They could change the outcome, but they can't prevent somebody from getting 270.
There you go. Mick Mulvaney, Melissa DeRosa. Let you guys get to whatever you do to watch this stuff. Get the popcorn ready. Thank you both very much. Appreciate that. Very quick check on the markets. Stocks went up again today, so we're at records. You go up. It's a new record because that's math. On deck, a wheel coming off a United Airlines Boeing jet during takeoff. The must-see video straight ahead. Plus, a huge bet on where NVIDIA may be heading next. And if you own NVIDIA, you are going to want to hear this. Tried to make a...
On May 10th, Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes is coming to IMAX and theaters everywhere.
What a wonderful day!
This summer, one movie event will reign.
It is our time.
They stole my village.
I know where they're taking your clan.
Bend for your king.
Never.
Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Only in theaters May 10th. Tickets on sale now. Rated PG-13. Some material may be inappropriate for children under 13.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
All right, let's get to tomorrow's news tonight. First up, Rivian shares surging today. They rolled out newer, smaller electric car models called the R2 and the R3. One's a small SUV. The other one looks a lot like a 1984 Peugeot 205, and I say that lovingly. But that is not all Rivian said today. Getting less press is that the EV maker said it will pause construction on a $5 billion planned factory in Georgia, the delay giving Rivian the ability to focus on its, quote, capital-efficient launch of the R2. Shares not moving on that news. Next up, Costco missing its holiday quarter revenue expectations. Shares are down right now, even though Costco posted nearly 20% year-over-year sales growth. And switching to chips, not the one that you eat where there's not enough in the bag. It's Broadcom, a major semiconductor supplier for Apple and other companies, also reporting their semiconductor revenue slightly missed estimates. Shares of Broadcom are down on the news. Broadcom, not really a name we talk a lot about on the show. I mean, NVIDIA eats all the oxygen. But for reference, Broadcom is actually the ninth largest company in the S&P 500, even now bigger than Tesla. That's an RBI. All right, it's a mixed bag for other chip stocks after hours, but it all comes as the NVIDIA mania marches on. Check this out. So far this year alone, NVIDIA has added more than $1 trillion in market value since January 1st. The hype around AI fueling some traders to bet in the options market that NVIDIA shares could hit $1,000 by March 24th, just like 3 weeks from now. Options activity can and does often move the underlying stock. So that kind of got us thinking. How much of the NVIDIA boom is actually options moving the stock? Let's bring in Tom Sosnoff, Tasty Trade founder and CEO, and some call him the godfather of options trading. You may have invented retail options trading, so grazie. There's some big bets on NVIDIA being placed, Tom. How does that affect, in very layman's terms, please, for our non-pro audience, how does that affect the underlying stock?
Well, you have to remember that when there's big bets on NVIDIA, the counterparty, meaning the person who's selling the options to the customers that are buying them, is one of the high-frequency firms. It could be Citadel, it could be Susquehanna, it could be any one of the big firms. So it affects NVIDIA in the way that these firms have to get ahead of the stock. So they might be buying some stock in anticipation of knowing that they're just kind of protecting their overall position in NVIDIA. You can't hedge NVIDIA using a stock index or using a future or something like that because it's too specific. So to hedge NVIDIA, you kind of got to be long stock and get ahead of it. And that's, I think that's where you're going with this. And I think that's the easy answer.
It's exactly where we're going, and we appreciate you explaining it because options can be wonky and they can be complicated for the non-pros out there. And I guess there's no way to quantify this directly, Tom, but in a way, is there any way to kind of gauge how much of the buying of NVIDIA is just people who love NVIDIA, love the story, they love the data center side, whatever it may be, and that options-related move that may have nothing to do with the underlying fundamentals of the business?
Well, I would say when you get to the point where NVIDIA is right now, very little of the trading in NVIDIA has to do with the fundamental story behind NVIDIA. You're talking about a stock at this point that it's a $900 stock that's trading with penny-wide markets. The depth of liquidity today in NVIDIA was off the charts. I mean, it was the number one stock traded on our platform today, and It just crushed everything else as far as just number of orders entered in NVIDIA. when you can trade a stock with, you know, almost a 60% implied volatility that's trading literally in penny-wide markets on with a $900 stock, you're talking about something that just attracts people. It's just an opportunity. So whether you're bullish or you're bearish, everybody just loves opportunity, liquid opportunity, efficient opportunity. That's what attracts. That's why the money's attracted there.
And do you see it continuing, Tom?
Well, at this point, Brian, there has been, I mean, it's actually picked up steam every day. I mean, today was kind of, you know, it picked up steam. And if you look at the markets tonight, especially with Costco kind of missing, and just like you talked about Broadcom missing, I mean, NVIDIA's up $17 tonight post-market, you know, it's trading right now. It's up $17 trading 943. I think it closed at 926 or 927 or something. So, I mean, this stock is just, it's a beast. And it really is bringing a lot of retail customers back, because this is nothing like a meme stock. This is not GameStop at all. This is a real company, a multi-multi-trillion-dollar company that is bringing a lot of people into the game. It's kind of like a replacement almost for Tesla, what Tesla was a couple of years ago.
Well said, and we'll leave it there. And thank you for laying it out. Options, a lot of bets out there. Tom Sosnoff, thank you.
Thanks.
All right, still ahead. It may be the healthiest sign we have seen for the record rally, and it really doesn't have anything to do at all with three of the market's biggest names. Plus, video you have to see, a Boeing jet's wheel falling off during takeoff tonight. That's next.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
All right, welcome back. It was another record day for the markets, another good day for your money. The NASDAQ, S&P 500, both hitting new record highs today. The Dow did close up. But as stocks overall are hitting record levels, so too is something else. Money market assets. The money and money market funds just hit a new record high for the second week in a row. There is now over $6 trillion sitting in money market fund assets. And here is something else that may surprise you. Some of the biggest stocks in tech are actually not having a great year, even in this record run. Apple. Apple's underperforming the S&P 500 so far this year. Same goes for Google parent Alphabet. And it's even worse for Tesla, with that stock down nearly 30% this year. So if Apple, Google, and Tesla are underperforming, what exactly is driving the S&P to new records? Well, obviously, it's NVIDIA and another couple other big names. But also take a look at this. Old IBM. Hitting all-time highs nearly every day, outpacing the broader markets. We just talked about it. Broadcom also surging. So is this sort of seeming shift a good sign for the markets going forward? Joining us now is Evans May, wealth managing partner, Elizabeth Evans, and Deepwater Asset Management managing partner, Doug Clinton. Elizabeth, from a macro perspective, do you care if Apple and Google underperform?
Good evening, Brian. In short, no, I don't think that speaks to the broader market or indicates underperformance. What's actually really interesting is if you look at the Magnificent Seven ETF MAGs and compare that to the S&P 500 equal weight RSP, what you'll see is year to date, MAGs has actually outperformed RSP, the equal weight S&P 500, by 10%. And over the last month, it's about flat. So that's even with the underperformance of those three companies.
Yeah, Doug, is this a healthy phenomenon?
I think it is healthy. I would be worried, Brian, if we saw all these Mag 7 names just moving in unison straight up the charts. I think what we're seeing actually is some healthy dispersion, where markets are sort of voting in favor of the companies that are showing the greatest relative growth, the NVIDIAs, the Metas, which is also up 50% plus this year. And they're sort of moving away from the companies that have had slower growth, Apple and Google. And for us, Google is the one that actually sticks out the most. We're owners of it in our core Titan strategy. We've been frustrated. I think it's becoming consensus to be frustrated with Google's sort of pace of AI development. And so it's becoming actually contrarian to like Google here, which we still do.
Well, that's a really interesting take. So, Doug, I'm going to come back to you then on that one. We just talked about NVIDIA. I don't know if you heard the conversation. NVIDIA, nearly $1,000 stock. Do you think that there's stocks that just get so expensive that people, maybe you and other people, are going out and just saying, you know, I can't afford $944 a share or buy enough to make money. Let's go find some less expensive on a little dollar value basis and run those up.
I don't know that I see that as much. I mean, with fractional share purchases now, even if you are a smaller investor, you can still buy some of these, you know, expensive stocks. When I look at what's happened with NVIDIA, it's hard to look at the chart and not be a little bit fearful emotionally as a human. But if you sort of separate yourself from that emotion and you look at the fundamentals, it's still trading at 33 times forward earnings. That's pricey, but I wouldn't say that it's crazy. And I think it pours a little bit of cold water on the idea that we're in a full-fledged bubble. You can't really be in a bubble when the greatest stock in the market right now is trading at, you know, 33 times earnings and growing like NVIDIA is.
Did I just, Elizabeth, semi-accidentally make the most bullish case for the market? $6 trillion in money market funds?
Well, I think you're absolutely right. That's 6 trillion reasons for equities to really have another leg up. And I think as soon as interest rates start to come down, you will see that cash deployed into equities.
Yeah, 6 trillion plus another couple trillion sitting in banks. I mean, it's just amazing. It's like somebody has a money printing machine out there somewhere. I can't figure it out. Elizabeth, Doug, thank you both very much. Do appreciate it. All right, coming up, a United Airlines Boeing jet losing a wheel during takeoff. That video coming up. Plus, a late winter surprise, potential warning sign around tomorrow's jobs number. All right, time now for a bonus. TNT, a United Airlines Boeing 777 bound for Japan, had a wheel fall off during takeoff, the incident taking place just a couple of hours ago at San Francisco Airport. Debris from the wheel damaging several cars in the parking lot. Thankfully, the plane was able to land safely in L.A., and more thankfully, nobody was hurt by the falling tire. Now, this follows the NTSB's new probe into a stuck rudder pedal incident last month on a United Boeing 737 MAX 8 flight. Are Boeing's troubles multiplying, or is it just over-scrutinized? Joining us now is Captain Dennis Tager. He is the spokesman for the Allied Pilots Association. He's an American Airlines pilot who flies 737s and apparently is a big fan of Last Call. So we're a fan of you, Dennis. Thank you very much for coming on. Do appreciate that. Listen, this got caught on video, so it's going to make its way around. Is this, though, something that's more common than we think and it or not?
No, things popping off airplanes, falling off airplanes is not common. It's not common for a door to blow off an airplane. You know, is this related? You got the video there. It's quite stunning. I'm just seeing it. This should not happen. So what we have here is an entire system. Yeah, Boeing is failing left and right, and we'll get to that next issue about the rudder pedals. But what we're looking at our union, and we've implored the FAA to put boots on the ground like they did with Boeing, with the airlines, to include their maintenance shops. There is such pressure going on right now, and not having enough metal or airplanes, as Boeing is failing to deliver them, is only going to put more pressure on the airplanes that currently exist. So there's no better time, there's no more higher demand time to focus on doing the job right than there is now.
I want to be very clear as well, because it looks like, I don't know if it's the tire or the whole wheel, and we're saying Boeing, but there is a chance that the tire had some issue. Maybe it was an issue of the tire manufacturer. Maybe there was something on the runway that caused this. We're not casting sort of guilt yet. And also, I got to imagine, Dennis, you're a pilot, so you know how big these tires are. It is a miracle that nobody was injured.
And you're right. This happens to be a Boeing airplane. It's how it's maintained. Did something fail? You know, this is an airplane that's been around a long time. These are enormous tires. They're just extraordinary in size. And we keep using this word miracle after the door blew off, a miracle. This one, a miracle. We've got to stop counting on miracles and be the creator of a safe industry. And that starts on the assembly line floor, out to the maintenance shops, and on my flight deck. in my cockpit. And this is the craziness that has just got to stop. And the solution is in the people and the systems that are organized by each stakeholder, Boeing, airlines, and right on down to the flight deck.
Yeah, we're showing some of the damage. You know, maybe we're lucky it was San Francisco Airport, because generally you take off and you go out over the water. Obviously, it didn't make it that far. But I was thinking, I drive by Newark Airport almost every day, Dennis, and I thought, my God, if that tire landed on the turnpike, you know, what could have happened? I know what a rudder is, but how does a rudder get stuck?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we're looking for information. Some of the reports we've seen, though not confirmed, is that it's been investigated, and it was some anomaly, perhaps with some valve that got super cold soaked, and then it basically prevented the rudder pedals from moving until it warmed up. That's speculation at this point. The bottom line is a new airplane landing on a runway and then having rudder pedals seize up on it is not normal. It's not a one-off. I saw one of your broadcasts and you talked about the doors, that maybe this is a one-off. These are not one-offs. With all due respect, Brian, these are warning bells. They're balloons going up. You pick your metaphor. We have a problem, and it doesn't just exist in Boeing. And here's the good news for everybody who's a little bit concerned about this, or a lot concerned. You should be concerned if no one's talking about it. And pilots and mechanics are talking about it right now.
Speaking of talking, when you and your fellow pilots get into a 737 cockpit, and by the way, my buddy is an American pilot. You probably know him. I won't say his name. And we've talked about this. His conversations with his fellow pilots have changed over the last couple of years in terms of what they talk about. Have yours?
Absolutely. You know, we fly both the NG, the previous model, and the MAX. And when I get on the MAX, I'm at a heightened state of alert. I'm not going to talk around it. It's just the reality, because for years now, every time Boeing has something happen, we lean towards what else you got. And on the business side, you know, we've seen 20% loss in share price, $30 billion in market cap. And now, because the aircraft are not being delivered, it's going to impact the supply side. So good for the sell side analysts. You're going to have a supply cap on it, which is going to create probably bigger yields. But for the average passenger flying, your ticket prices will be higher because of Boeing. Airline management teams will rightfully be pressurizing their metal, their aircraft, to do as much as possible and utilize them as high a rate as possible. And in all of that righteous commercial venture, we have to make sure that we don't lose the ultimate goal, and that is the safety margin.
Listen, we appreciate it, Dennis. I fly all the time, flying next Friday. And honestly, I was just on a MAX 9, but now I'm kind of actively seeking like the old 757 or something. You know what I mean? Like, why not? It's been around for 30 years. Let's do it. Dennis Tager. Really appreciate your views and insight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. Another big story for tomorrow, and really the economy, is the jobs number. And your next guest cautions that tomorrow's number could come in a bit lower than expected. And he has correctly predicted the last two. Joining us now is Zeta Global CEO David Steinberg. Zeta uses AI-powered software to identify and provide data trends. Okay, so you got your AI crystal ball. All right, David, you've been right the last couple of ones. Why are you thinking this number might come in weaker when pretty much every number has just been stronger?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me, Brian. Always love seeing you. We definitely think we're going to see lower numbers tomorrow. We, based on all of the data we're seeing in the Zeta data cloud, all of the survey data we're compiling, we think we're going to see an interesting sort of compatible to last September, October, where you saw a really big September and then a much weaker October. Now, of course, it bounced back after that. But we think January was very, very strong. We think that February is going to be weak.
And what are one or two things that you are seeing, your AI is seeing, your team is seeing, that would be the biggest things that would sort of draw you to that conclusion?
And first of all, we're seeing for the first time pay begin to drop. 11% of respondents felt or said they were making less money now than they were. We're also seeing it longer to get a job. We're seeing almost three times the number of people today who believe there's scarcity in jobs or they're going to be harder to come by than we saw even 3 or 4 months ago. You know, and we're seeing a greater percentage of people being laid off. It's not just big tech. We're seeing layoffs across the board, and we're seeing a number of industries that are experiencing specific weakness.
Pay going down is, I doubt that's something we're going to hear about tonight, but these are the advanced trends that you and your team see before others, and that's why you've nailed it. David Steinberg of Zeta Global, thank you.
Thank you, Brian.
All right. Coming up, Netflix taking its biggest swing yet at live sports, and they're already kind of getting an earful about this bout. All right, do you know what happened 37 years ago? Iron Mike Tyson became the youngest heavyweight champion to win the World Boxing Association belt. He beat James Bone Crusher Smith after 12 rounds in Las Vegas on March 7, 1987. Tyson made his professional debut in 1985. During the peak of his career, he earned an estimated $30 million per fight, that according to the New York Times. And now Tyson, at 57 years old, is headed back into the ring. He will be fighting YouTuber-turned-boxer Jake Paul at AT&T Stadium, where the Cowboys play, in Texas this summer. The boxing mega event will air live on Netflix. It is Netflix's latest efforts to expand their live sports offerings. They've hosted tennis, golf, and will soon be streaming World Wrestling Entertainment's Monday Night Raw. What other sports events could Netflix offer, and is this more stunt than sports? Let's bring in sports business analyst Joe Pompliano to discuss investor at Pomp Investments, host of the Joe Pomp Show. I'm going to watch it. I mean, I'm just going to be honest, because I don't know if this is like some sort of a, is it a real, in your mind, you think Tyson's going to be 58 when he fights? You think it's going to be a real fight or more just kind of a stunt?
Yeah, thanks for having me, Brian. I mean, this announcement took the internet by storm today. We could talk about a lot of things. I mean, the fact that he's going to be nearly 60 years old when this fight takes place is obviously a little bit crazy, and they're going to sell a lot of tickets. I'm going to watch, you're going to watch, a lot of people are going to watch, given Netflix has 260 million subscribers. But Netflix is actually the most interesting part about this to me. If you think about Netflix, they had a first mover advantage when it came to streaming. And they've sat back and watched all of their competitors over the last few years spend billions of dollars on live sports rights. And they've really taken a very different approach. Rather than going after the competition aspect of live sports, they've gone after the entertainment aspect. We're talking about docuseries like Drive to Survive and Full Swing. They have a bunch of documentaries like the recent one on David Beckham. And now they're doing these live events. They've done one for golf. They just did one for tennis. And now they're going to do one for boxing. And I think this is a really smart strategy because not only is this network, is this streaming service now imperative for sports fans, but they're the only streaming service that's profitable still. And their churn rate is significantly lower at 2% compared to 4 to 8% for all of their competitors.
And it worked, and we're talking about it. One thing I worry about is this, and sports adjacent, is, you know, on the internet, there's always people doing these incredibly dangerous things now to get YouTube likes or Instagram likes. Some people are getting hurt or killed. And I wonder if this is the first step in the Netflix is sort of taking away from Instagram and YouTube and saying, you know what, instead of you jumping your dirt bike over 300 cars on YouTube, we'll pay you to do it on Netflix.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, it all comes down to audience and attention. And if you think about Mike Tyson, he certainly has that, and he's built that over the last several decades through his name in the boxing ring and outside of it. But Jake Paul is just as equivalent to this fight and just as necessary as for this fight as Mike Tyson is, right? He's going to bring a tremendous amount of viewers through his social media presentation and promotion of this fight. So I think Netflix hit the nail on the head here, and they're going to really go after this entertainment aspect of sports rather than the competition aspect that we've come to see across the professional sports leagues in the U.S.
Who would you bet on?
I don't know. People are saying online that Mike Tyson's going to kill him. The guy's nearly 60 years old, so it doesn't really seem like a fair fight, but I'm certainly going to watch and find out.
Yeah, and Jake Paul is a real fighter. People thought he was joking. He's not. He's, I think, 27. Tyson will be 58, but he is still Mike Tyson. And we're talking about it, so Netflix wins. Joe Pompliano, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
All right, coming up, we are just over an hour away from the State of the Union address and one of America's biggest economic achievements may not get any mention at all. Halim McCroft, next. All All right, I do want to come in with a news alert on Boeing. We just talked about it, but if you're just joining us, a tire or a wheel fell off of a Boeing jet taking off from San Francisco. The jet was headed to Japan. It rerouted, landed safely at LAX. Nobody was hurt. We don't know the cause. Maybe something hit the tire, popped it. We don't know. But it's getting a lot of attention. Luckily, the tire did not hurt anybody. Crushed a couple cars, by the way, in a San Francisco airline parking lot. But that was about it. Boeing stock is down 1% right now. All right. We are just about 1 hour away. Whoa. Breaking news graphic even surprised me. We're about an hour away from President Biden's State of the Union address. It is unclear, though, if the president will actually address, reference, mention, record high oil and gas production in the United States. In fact, it's not only natural gas and oil, it's also solar and wind. They've all reached record highs under President Biden. In fact, the U.S. is currently producing more oil than any country ever has in the history of the world. Production jumped more than 80% in the past 10 years, but the president rarely mentions those accolades. Joining us tonight is RBC Capital Markets Head of Global Commodity Strategy, Halima Croft, also a contributor. It's a sticky slope. I know you're not a political analyst, but it is a sticky slope with the president because you want to brag about what we've done, but at the same time, a lot of his base is going to be like, I don't want to hear about record fossil fuel production.
No, because remember, he came into office essentially saying,
phase them out.
Yes, yeah, shrink the footprint of oil and gas. But then the inflation concerns became paramount. And then all of a sudden, it was basically yelling at OPEC to put more barrels on the market, releasing the SPR, and at one point telling companies, don't return the cash to shareholders, put it in the ground.
Yeah, which is a truly, listen, the president is a skilled politician. That's why he was elected before you were born to national office. And it's, we went from in 4 or 5 years, we're going to phase them out, oil and gas are doomed, to record high U.S. production of not just oil, but we're literally shipping more natural gas than any country in the world.
I mean, I think this is where the energy security imperative kicked in and also the inflation concerns. But you had a war involving one of the world's largest natural gas producers. And all of a sudden, the Biden administration was like, get those LNG cargoes on the water into Europe. And it was really U.S. LNG that played an incredible role in saving Europe, thwarting Putin's ambitions to give Europe a winter of discontent. But now the Biden administration going into election mode is like, hang on, LNG.
Now we're going to pause.
We're going to pause.
I mean, it's. I tip my hat to the White House team. They're very good at it.
Yes.
We're going to phase them out. We're going to drill more. We're going to add more LNG. But now we're going to pause it.
Right.
But it's a political game.
It is a political game. The question is it going to buy them a lot of capital with progressives? And it's interesting, you look at a producer like Qatar and they're like, game on. We're going to double down on LNG. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, does it matter that there is a pause? If there's a second Biden administration, will that quickly be phased out? Like, what's the long-term policy when it comes to LNG permitting?
Well, you tell me, because every time I look at you on social media, you're like in some other country. So I've never met anybody who travels as much as you, which is a huge compliment because you're actually on the ground talking to people. And you and I talked to some of the same people.
Yes.
Is Europe worried about this LNG pause?
Again, I think it's a question about what does the future look like? I mean, certainly the Qataris are like, we're here. We're here to service you. We're not stepping back. But the question is, if Ukraine loses, if Russia is really able to dictate terms, the question is Europe going to potentially have to rethink their relationship with Russian gas? Is Russian gas going to make its way potentially back
into
Europe?
Did you watch my segment on Squawk Box on this fine show the other day?
I did.
You were probably on a plane where I have talked to people who have also talked to people at very high levels, and there are certain very high-level German officials who will whisper
yes,
that they may have to help rebuild the Nord Stream pipeline.
No,
their entire economic model is based on that thing.
Right. So if the United States is seen as potentially stepping back, will Europe say we have to reevaluate potentially with Russia?
Well, that's a good lever. If I was a European energy official, Habeck, whoever in Germany, I might use that to twist the U.S. administration a little bit. You don't want us going back on Russian gas, do you?
Right.
Right. Don't pause because while we're still going to double exports in the next
right,
couple
of
years,
course.
I want to be clear. We're still going to double exports of LNG. Huge projects are not going to be built because they require 20-year timelines.
Right.
And then he guarantees a future cash flow.
Right. So again, the question is this a pause or is essentially shelving these projects?
What do you think? I feel like I'm being interviewed by you.
No,
I don't like, I don't know the answer.
No, I don't. It depends. I mean, I think if it's a Trump administration, we know the answer.
Yeah.
And the question is, who's going to be in the Biden administration and what will the world outlook
okay.
look like?
Okay, let's make a bet. We got 30 seconds of the okay. show. I'll bet you a coffee some point in Austria.
Big spender.
In okay. Austria. Okay, in Austria. Does the president mention or brag about record high oil production tonight?
I don't think he brags about record high oil production. I think he brags about the IRA, but I don't think he...
He'll say record energy, right?
He might say energy, but again, I'm not sure he's going to be the all of the above guy tonight.
That's a good... I think we agree. I don't think the word oil will be mentioned tonight, but we got to go. Halima Croft, thank you.
Thank you.
As always, folks, what do you think? Let's take a bet. Oil mentioned, yes or no?
Energy?
See you tomorrow. Take care.
This podcast is supported by FedEx. Dear small and medium businesses, no one wants happy customers more than you do. That's why FedEx offers you picture proof of delivery, packageless and paperless returns, as well as weekend home delivery to 98% of the U.S. on Saturday and 50% on Sunday. See the FedEx service guide for delivery information. FedEx Ground service is also faster to more locations than UPS Ground. See what FedEx can do for your business. Absolutely, positively, FedEx.